This is part three of the oral history interview with Margaret Kett Ziegart, recorded on May 8th, 2017.
We are resuming our interview with Kett Ziegart, and in this segment, we're going to talk about what she's been doing post-retirement as a high school teacher up to today.
Several days ago, I met someone, and they said that they left Tama High School District in 1981. And I said, well, that's just about the time I was given a program of mentorship for 5 years after I left the classroom. So I stayed in the district of Tamalpais High School for 25 years. She, on the other hand, was not able to get a job, and so she stopped teaching and found some other field. Because at that time, there was a way to reduce the teachers who had a higher income because they'd been in the district longer. And there was this new program that the state and the school districts following. And we were given $5,000 each year as a mentor. Well, of course, it wreaks havoc with your Social Security. Because as a teacher, your Social Security is minimal because the state teachers voted not to have Social Security option, and our Marin County, as opposed to San Francisco, decided to have our own retirement program. The mentorship then gave me the opportunity of having $5,000, and I sort of used that as gold money because I didn't have the responsibility of time, and my children were quite well grown or else they were in school, and my daughter was going to school, so I was able to travel. And one of the last years that I was teaching, my department chair in the fine arts department was Bob Greenberg, but my immediate arts and head former chair of the art department was Henri Boussy, who retired. And Henri had been teaching a weaving class, and so I had to teach weaving, and I told them I couldn't unless they would get me a student teacher that knew how to draft a loom. And they found one, a student teacher. I thought they wouldn't. So I was teaching weaving without a real background in weaving, because the only weaving I'd ever done was on a loom that was already set up in a church summer school program. However, there are lots of excellent books, and there were resource books. And I had this woodshop make plank looms. First thing they came in the classroom, we made a finger loom. Four fingers, like the, when I was small, we'd had a thing with thread. What is spool? We'd had a spool, and you had little nails, and you went through the spool. What you do is you use your hand as the nails, and you can make a long cord. And so you can, the boys and the girls in the class did the same thing. My classes were always co-educational in opportunity and in expectations. And I had basic expectations. When the kids came in the room, and they were a variety, and often they had been put in by counselors because they weren't really very successful in terms of learning in a linear fashion, because which would be like, you know, words following words. They were more holistic, and they had an overall concept that they approached a problem. They were good problem solvers. They're the kinds of kids that were very good in shops. They're not dumb. They're just not an academic linear learner. And so those were the kids that helped me out when I didn't have a film that worked or something, machine or something broke. They could always fix something. And we had a lot of interesting kinds of things that we did, because as a teacher, you had all kinds of disciplines in an art program that you had to cover. Weaving, was not one of them that I'd ever anticipated. So Henri Boussy suggested that I go to Finland, and because I'm Finnish, and learn weaving. Well, I don't think he knew that they draft backwards. Sweden is like all the other nations of the world, but the Finns are doing just the opposite. But I learned how to draft, how to pull a loom, and then subsequently I taught, and then I also took courses at College of Marin. So I was able always, you know, to learn ahead of myself. And that's what a good teacher does, because you don't want to just stay with the same things. The world changes, and the kinds of kids, about every 10 years in those days, the whole kind of opportunity, learning, challenge came and changed. So there was just a pattern. So you always were doing something different. And to me, that was what made teaching such an exciting thing, because you worked with all different kinds of kids. But there was always a kind of a general mode where you approached the classroom. My very simple category of discipline was, when you come in the room, you get your folder out. In your folder should only be your own work. If you ever take other students' work that you like and erase their name and put your name on to turn it in, as some highly achieving kids did with all the pressures to succeed. Some of the kids did that, or they wanted to be better than they thought they were. Then I had a variety of artists' work to show them, and certainly the range of contemporary artists is mighty. And if you're using perspective, you have all kinds of perspectives that you teach the kids, because one of them is the kind of perspective of which they are comfortable with. So you don't take anybody else's work, and you get kicked out for that, and you get kicked out if you throw clay in the classroom. Those were the two things. I never expected to have the Boy Scout, the boy who has all the badges.
Oh, the Eagle Scout? An Eagle Scout?
A Scout, special...
Eagle Scout.
I never expected, when my tools were taken once in a carving class, and these were tools, carving tools, carving sets of tools. When those tools were taken in a carving class, we didn't use soap. I got soapstone. I would go up and get soapstone and get clay up in the mountains with my children. We'd go up and we'd get... I always tried to have professional materials. The tools weren't all turned in. One set was not turned in. And so I said, well, you'll all have to stay in the classroom till the tools get turned back, because they were sharp. And everyone kept looking around. And the person actually, finally, Mrs. Ziegert will be late the next class. We'll lose credit, you know. I'm sorry. This is your responsibility in the classroom. Well, it turned out the tools were turned in by an Eagle Scout. Word got back, certainly, to the principal of how I embarrassed this child, and also the principal told me that I should not be using tools that could be dangerous. So I turned in all the tools, and I got saw blades. And saw blades have a smooth edge, and then they have a jagged edge, but they're not dangerous. But you can saw away and you can smooth out, so they work just fine. Another innovation that I found, because when I teach, I get clay on myself or I get paint, and by then we were using acrylic paints. I always got the professional Utrecht acrylic paints. We always made our own canvases. I'd bring in board and then I'd get linen canvas from Utrecht, and the kids would make their own little things and then stretch their own little canvases. And then if they wanted to and they had the money or they were more interested, they could buy stretcher bars themselves and make a stretch canvas. So after my demanding days of teaching and my most pleasurable days of teaching because I really like young people. I began to take classes at College of Marin because they had a printing press. The very first year, I went and took courses with John Ely, who had been a member of the California Society of Etchers and Engravers, and who taught at San Francisco State, and this was his final year of teaching. So I wanted to take a class with him, so I did quite a few prints there. And then the next semester, I also took classes. And the neat thing about the program in those years was that we could stay all day and all night. The room was open to us, and so we stayed late at night. So I did quite a bit of work, and I did some monotypes printing there. Then I moved over to College of Marin because it was closer, and parking at and spending the day hiking, getting a free parking place. You had to walk quite a ways, and with art supplies and everything, it was much better to be at College of Marin. And so I've been taking courses ever since in all places. When I was at Tamalpais High School, I received a opportunity to teach overseas in an international exchange program. So in England, I learned to appreciate the opportunity of theater and programs, so I began to incorporate those into my post-college, post-teaching, new career of being a retired person. Well, of course, retiring wasn't something in my bones because I had always been working since I was 12. And I had this strong sense of responsibility to your community. So I continued doing a little bit of art, traveling as much as I could, and I went to some splendid places, and I had 18 elder hostel courses that I had taken. And the reason is that because people counted up how many they had taken, that was part of the program. I would take a class like that, and then I would travel independently, and then use that as a way to meet people and to have an opportunity for interchange with adults that I could speak to, because I was never good at languages and I had no language proficiency at all. I once tried to learn French, spent a lot of time, and when I went to turn in some photographs, the processor, no speak of French. That's when I stopped speaking French completely. But I took two wonderful programs in Paris. One of them was through the University of California, and the head of the Sorbonne was the teacher. And I have a small drawing, that image that he made. He offered us the opportunity of buying some of his work, and of course I had to find the least expensive one, but something that is nice. It's a little rainbow. The next time I went through Hayward State, and you take a 6-week summer program, and you take the full 20 units, or 18 units, I guess it is. And one of my units was economics, something that I have absolutely no interest in, but that was an offering. And when we got to Paris, the teacher said, I'm sorry that I had you do any pre-reading, and we can't use the text because they've just changed us to the euro. So we read The Economist as our text. The opportunities were fantastic for me. I've been to Germany 2 times. Most of the museums, since we were students, were open if they were the government museums. But of course, Monet's weren't, but I still went to his museums two or three times because I really liked his work. I still like to go to museums. The current Monet show now is very special because it's of works that aren't really shown any, haven't been shown anywhere, and avail yourself of seeing the gifted eye of a wonderful painter who was already, as a young person, knowing where he was going. The opportunity, of course, is more limited now that I'm mobility limited at 90 years old, but I still consider myself quite fortunate that I have friends who go and that I have whistle stop, much to my chagrin. You lose about 2 hours because you could never be sure about the transportation because of the traffic congestion, which is getting worse and worse. But when I was driving, I could go almost anywhere, and I did. I have a family cottage. I would go with my children many times, but then I began going by myself as well, driving up and enjoying to being up there along the Smith River. And in Del Norte County, it's a very reactionary or conventional or limited community. It's one of the two poorest counties in the state. And until they had the Pelican Bay Prison, which is the worst prison inmate composition, it had really no employment opportunities. The saddest thing is Walmart has come in, and all the private businesses, the ones that have been struggling for so many years, are now closed. All of them are closed, and you just have Ace Hardware or all of the conventional for this small community and for the counties there, and then across into Oregon and Brookings. The concerns there, of course, for a small group of people, not the community leaders, is to retain the wilderness and that aspect. Long ago, I would identify things that I thought should be saved in my immediate neighborhood of my Douglas Park community, which is like five houses then, and a sign outside that one of my close friends goes in convulsions over because it says congestion ahead, and then there are just five houses. And this is on a road to Stout Grove, which is at the Jedediah State Park.
How did you happen to get a cabin up in that area?
The reason we got up in that area is because I traveled across the United States twice with my children, and we would camp at campgrounds. The first year, we had the very first trip, my colleague and wife said, "Ket, you really, really ought to get out, you know, get away from Mill Valley for the summer, do something." I said, "I can't possibly afford to do it." "Yes, you can. When anything's on sale, there's three for $2 or two for one. Put the second one in a box." And so that's what I did, following her suggestions. And we had boxes of Argentina beef, canned beef, and tuna fish, and a few canned chicken, which we didn't like so much, and then canned vegetables, and plotted out with AAA exactly where we were going, and we were going to stop up in northern Washington, up north on the coast in Washington State, where my mother's brother's wife was still living. And it worked out to be a benefit, but at the time it seemed disastrous. We had a new Volkswagen bus, 666 miles on it, and a deer jumped in front of the car and smashed the entire front. And this was the 4th of July weekend. Actually, it was while I was still teaching that I began doing this, traveling with my children. This was the first trip, but I had to tell you how we happened to have the place up in Del Norte County, which was a treasured place for all of us. Mm-hmm. And on the Smith River, which is a wild river, and there are all these groups of people trying to log off and utilize areas that should be saved. So I'd see something that I thought that Save the Redwoods League should work on, and I'd let them know. Unfortunately, they were able to buy a part of a land right near the forks, the meeting of the forks. Later, I had conversations with people that had lived there early on, and one of them was a man, and I had found out that Jedediah Smith had crossed the river at a different place than that people had surmised from one of his fellow persons, Rogers, which was in a different location, and one that the park had said was the one that was where it was. But then Jedediah's journal was found, and it verified what the Native Americans had told the man whom I first had spoken with, who was an informal historian of the area. And Jedediah had crossed at the Peacock Farm area. And also, I became interested then in Jedediah Smith, and my kids that aren't even aware that I am, but I've done a print of that I have given them, the Jedediah State Park Society, and several of my friends, like Chet Crawford, who's of Mount Crawford, was a wonderful counselor and a very, very good friend, especially of my son John, but a good family friend and a near neighbor. And I'd give him one called Serpentine Cliffs, because on top of the Serpentine Cliff, Jedediah Scouts, Rogers and another man, had walked ahead and had looked out and decided they didn't want to go inland, they wanted to go north, up a creek called Myrtle Creek. And Jedediah wasn't with them, but in Myrtle Creek, that's where a number of his people were killed. But there are two different Native stories that this man had of people, their first white man that had ever come from Native American transcribed orally history. Because history, I think, is transcribed orally, and in fact, I know that it is. The biblical rewriting of the first five books of the Bible were written by a gentleman who said he was writing, his writings were poetry in the manner of Emily Dickinson. And I was really irked, and this was about 26 years ago, because my now 27-year-old granddaughter was actually imitating her mother liked Gaelic folk songs, and she was picking up the word patterns, and the words are conveyed through a pattern, a repetitive pattern, not through imagery, you know. So anyway, one of the things I did after I retired was I started to do, and I have the images. I only still have done half of the writing. So that's something I'm going to do if I live long enough.
You're going to write about these?
No,
you're going to transcribe?
And I used the Aramaic. At the time I was using the Aramaic, there weren't any English translations, only one book, but that was Genesis. And so that's where I was, so that was fine. And I got that copy at the Baptist Seminary library, which had the most marvelous view. And one of their professors was an archaeologist, and so he'd set up a little museum. It was just a wonderful place to go. So I did things like that after I retired, you know, but always related to art or something that I had inquired about. In Del Norte County, I became very aware of land use, and I tried to have Save the Redwoods League, and they did acquire some of the land up there, and I still stay in and I'm even leaving a portion of my very small estate to the college group of people and then the group of people in Del Norte, because they are working against fantastic odds. And the Coastal Commission, for the whole of California up there is always opposed to anything liberal. They want to, of course, build and make money because money is so desperate. They want to build against the coast, and so it's been preserved, you know, through efforts. In Mill Valley, there is a significant problem because our available nice building sites, supposedly, and old properties are being acquired by people who have large incomes and have this concept of having vast, large homes, not necessarily to you live in, but as an investment, I think. When I was teaching school, I had a young girl whose father was interested and was a community planner. And there was a discussion of having, at the end of the high school football field, a marsh made into a parking lot for cars from Mill Valley. And we had an Almonte community, and the Almonte community, long before I was here, built their own clubhouse. And I was on the board of that Almonte District Improvement Club for quite a few years. And so I decided that I was going to make a petition up and informed everybody about how awful this was. So I have the letter copied from many years ago. And fortunately, we had enough people in our community and the school itself who didn't really want a parking lot on their land, which was adjacent to the football field. Not that the football field wasn't used for other things, because then another time when they wanted to build housing on the school lands because the school was getting rid of property, elementary schools were selling or renting, fortunately, one of the schools in Strawberry, leasing for a number of years until the enrollment changes. Well, the enrollment right now is at a peak, and they're getting portables again at Tamalpais High School, and they have a terrible plan, and so I'm still involved because their terrible plan is to build a three-level parking garage with access from Almonte Boulevard. And probably the most terrible personal problem is that because I live on a non-county maintained road, our road has been absolutely demolished because GPS puts everyone on our road because it's a straight road. And even though the straight road, Lark Lane, is so narrow, there's no parking, people on our road are parking and making it difficult to back out of my own driveway. And we had had an agreement between the woman across the street who used to live there, who had trouble getting out of her driveway because she had to back out straight. When I use three cars in my driveway, you have to back out straight. Not right now, there's not three cars, there's only one. But it's difficult for my friends who are now older to back out and around. The road, however, is getting worse and worse. So I was just told several days ago that we're going to pay $2,000 to repair the road again. And it's
hard, isn't it?
Well, we're doing
it's
it.
It's not fair.
It's not being done by the tax of the community, mm-hmm. because everybody thinks they pay for the roads, and they're not. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the kind of issue that it revolves around land use mm-hmm. that I'm interested in. But mm-hmm. the very first time, I think, was the Almonte Marsh, and we saved that. Now my big plea, if you want to know,
I do want
to
know,
is to get ponding areas of every single parking area. That would be, they're against the creeks. There's one in downtown Mill Valley, and there was it was putting through the program, and I suggested that maybe 3 years ago because I have been following BCDC, which is Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and BCDC and SPUR, which is a San Francisco planning, urban planning research group, I guess. I don't know what the R is for. And Plan Bay Area. There are three groups that have been planning for people. And the Plan Bay Area particularly, these are people that are not voted in. These are people that are appointed. And so they make programs. And many years before this, I worked on a transportation group with a transportation group by going into their annual meeting and taking attendance, because even then I was falling down. I guess it must have been 15 years ago. I don't know. Anyway, they were talking about doing exactly what's happening now, but it was 15 years ago. And we only had two people from Marin for the whole making the whole Bay Area decisions. And of course, my voice isn't very loud because I'm speaking against all the other people who were planning on getting money for improved transit and transportation by linking it with the housing development. Well, this is something that I could go on for hours about, but I am not only interested in land use and management, but in the relationship of the transportation and population growth and population separation, which I think is wrong, between the affluent and the low income. And a developer wants to make money. He comes in from the Midwest. He comes in from the Bay Area. He comes over from China, buys up land. There was a time when much of our land was purchased by Chinese. Before that, the Persian affluent people came fleeing the time. So we have a variety of people who do not understand the kind of values that I was brought up with, both my mother and my father in their extension work, and then later by my mother, who revived and wrote a new way for post-heart people. My mother would be delighted because I have heart problems now, and I, you know, don't lay in bed all the time. The first thing they do is try to get you up out of bed to get to do things and become more able and not just give up after the first heart attack.
Let me ask you again about these issues that you're passionate about.
Well, passionate about, I think, to have the rights of the people involved and not to have manipulation.
Right.
And there's political manipulation. For an example, and this probably will not be happily received by the supervisors, but about 7 years ago in one of the discussions about housing, the Marin City had their own housing authority. They were merged into a larger home, so they only had a two-person vote, I think, generally speaking, on a larger group, and the authority wanted to have the buildings torn down that were designed by an associate, Mr. Green of Frank Lloyd Wright. They wanted to have them torn down because they get credit for having new housing. If it's new housing, renovated housing, they won't. So they didn't repair them. They decided to do that 7 years ago at a meeting that I was attending.
So I was going to ask you how it is
so
that
I'm
you...
discouraged about,
right.
about the well-meaning people who are always canceled out, not always, who are successful, but then they get stuck where they were. Now, there's a wonderful woman called Phyllis Faber, and she has a very strong responsibility and interest in West Marin. Everyone loves oysters. I'd never eaten an oyster till half a year ago. Oh, they're marvelous. I can see why everybody wants to have more oysters. But the national park, by having gone to national parks with my children all across the country, I realized that internationally and nationally, national parks and international parks are the thing that keeps the culture of a community or places where you live. Because otherwise everything looks like a strip mall. When you go into a town, it's all the same. But when you have a national park, you have the opportunity to go back and recreate or preserve or interpret what was there before. So that's a strong commitment. And then I have the commitment to equality and opportunity for everyone, because I taught those kinds of kids and I know how important each child is, you know. So you become, not only because your parents had that viewpoint, but your own personal experiences and your own family. And you knew how you feel about your own family. Well, they should have a family right too, and they work hard. Now I'm using Whistle Stop all the time. It's incredible the kinds of wonderful people that work the buses on Whistle Stop. Mm-hmm. Often they're people who've had, you know, successful careers. Yesterday the person had been in management and in working with funds, bond funds, and through one of the very important funds that sort of went a little bit down during the last thing, and he's old, past retirement age, and he still wants to keep working a bit, because to be retired now at age 65 is silly, because people are energetic and live longer. And like myself, you outgrow whatever assets you had. So I use Whistle Stop. I could take a nice program they have for 8 cabs called Catch a Cab within this transportation program that your doctor signs you up for if you can no longer walk down to the public transportation. I live on a hill, so I can't walk down. The neat thing about my house, which is near Tam High School, is that it's flat. Never occurred to me that a flat driveway was anything better than for the little kids to play on when you're just looking at a house. But you never think of yourself. But I'm now dependent on either Whistle Stop or friends. Often friends take me home after a meeting, because you never know how long the meeting is going to last. But I still try to go to as many meetings as I can. And the current problem is, at Tamalpais High School, they're making a master plan, and they are planning on having a 3-story parking garage with a 4th level to have tennis courts on the 4th level. Well, my daughter played tennis, and there were lots of stray balls, so I don't know how they're going to handle the stray balls or the people looking or watching the tennis meets.
So you went to a city council meeting about that topic last week,
I did the other day, because I kept telling the city council that I had read in a wonderful, wonderful publication that the Tamalpais High School magazine talked about in January. There was this plan and the presentation, so I kept mentioning it, because Miller Avenue, which was just being developed when I came here, and part of Miller Avenue was to build out a Southern California-style engineer, Pratsker. His wife later became a mayor of the city council. He had designed this whole master plan, architecturally, of filling in Upper Richardson Bay. Bothine Marsh was a dried area. The people in Tam Valley, and a wonderful, I can't recall his name, man that lived up here on Morning Sun, who was a specialist in marshes and water, had a channel open so that the marsh could be flushed again. And so Bothine Marsh was revived. Now there's a group of people called One Tam. And I worry about the fact that with this incoming climate change, which actually is, it's gone up 8 inches in the last, you know, few decades.
Sea levels?
At the gate. So, I mean, it's a really literal thing, and the ice flows are melted. The whole environment is changing. But not only that, we're changing our environment in many other ways. You know, cutting down the trees, we need the trees, we need the oxygen, we need... We need to plant trees, the kind of trees that we have. I went to a meeting and I said, you want to cut down the bay trees because they're the ones that are causing the southern oak death. And the forester at the time hadn't read the information that I'd read. I read a lot of information. I don't remember it all. I file it. I have files that are just going to have to be thrown out. But some things are really important to keep. But some things now are back in the public knowledge. And now they know that you need to have rhododendrons, which are beautiful, beautiful. And bay trees removed around the area, especially when we have damp times for the oaks. So kinds of things like that, they're stretching about a long ways. But the transportation and the housing started off, and they even changed the name of the group, and to me, I can't recall right this very minute. But they met in Oakland, and they were from San Francisco and the entire Bay Area. And the relationship was that you had the two things tied together so that you did have people building homes, because after the federal government had stopped giving the grants for building at the Reagan years, after that, then you didn't have public housing. And public housing is not a curse. It's a blessing to a community because it keeps it balanced. And right now, transportation and housing opportunities in San Francisco aren't balanced, and they certainly aren't balanced in our area because we don't have much space. In many areas, they keep building out, but we really can't really build out. And our infill spaces were changed. Property ownerships of large parcels are being used for affluent developments. So those are the kinds of things that still concern me. And another reason that I started, I think, honestly, when my children were still little, to be interested, and I was on one of the first groups that Peter Baer appointed, where we evaluated housing because there was a moratorium, and we had a checklist that was a model, and people came from Hawaii and other communities to see our model. And one of the modeled communities that won in this competition was Whiskey Springs, and the other one was the Baptist Seminary. And now there are a few people like Don Dickinson, who was a planner at that time, then became a planner for the city of Mill Valley, and then has gone back to the county and served on different planning boards, particularly the Planning Commission. But very few people remember why this was set up the way it was. Mm-hmm. And the build-out that had been planned and allowed for has already been made. There is space there, but that space is there because it's such a significant place and spot that overlooks the entire Bay Area.
That's right. You know,
so that's the kind of thing that I'm doing as I get older. And I'm almost too old, but I still go with my cane and walk up to the microphone. And I forget to announce that at the city council that I'm Margaret Ketnan Ziegler, that lives at 118 Highland Lane, Mill Valley. But I used to teach in Mill Valley, so I basically was originally a citizen of the city of Mill Valley. But then, that's how I became interested.
I'm going to thank you for this wonderful, extensive oral history and discussion. It's so clear to me that you've been passionate all of your life about many things, art and people and teaching, finally, and your care about the environment and the people around you. I just think it comes through so clearly in this review.
Well, I certainly love the Mill Valley Library. I can think of no other place. I started to say confessionally, I didn't have any money to contribute any place, and I didn't have any social life that I had to spend money for, because most things you have to spend money for. But I wanted to interact with people. And so I spent the money that I had to travel to interact with different cultures when I had it, never expecting to live this long. but I'm continuing to do things. And having a car was just a wonderful thing, so I regret. But I don't think I should really drive anymore, I've convinced myself, because when I sit down now, I fall asleep.
Well, I look forward to seeing you at the library,
yes,
or around town, well, for another decade at least.
Oh, I don't think so.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.